at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This fall, Pope Benedict called the world's 1 billion Catholics to a year of faith, a time, he said, of commitment to a more complete conversion to God. The year of faith coincides with another key moment for Catholics, the 50-year anniversary of an extraordinary gathering of bishops worldwide called Vatican II. Now, 5 decades later, there's been a lot of soul-searching on that anniversary and what it means. Most Catholics agree that Vatican II ushered in dramatic changes from how the faith was practiced internally to how it related to the external world. But there's disagreement on how to interpret the message of Vatican II and whether or not it's now time for a further opening up of the Church with another council, perhaps a Vatican III. Today in The Exchange, we review Vatican II, why it was so important for Catholics and how they see it today. Let's hear from you, too. If you're Catholic, how do you feel about the changes that stemmed from this? And even if you're not Catholic, what questions do you have about what Vatican II meant for one of the world's major religions? Give us a call. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us at exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. We have 2 guests with us in studio, Father Michael Kerper, pastor of St. Patrick Parish in Nashua. He also writes for Parable Magazine. And Father Kerper, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Sister Maureen Sullivan, Associate Professor of Theology at St. Anselm College, an expert on the Second Vatican Council. She's also a Dominican Sister of Hope in New York. And Sister Maureen, welcome back, and it's good to see you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, both of you, lots of people listening won't even know what Vatican II was and why it matters. So I just want to take a couple minutes right now because it's really interesting. And Sister Maureen, I'll start with you. You teach this at St. Anselm College, so you're sort of our expert. Vatican II was a huge gathering called by the Pope in 1962 of more than 2,000 bishops who felt called by the Holy Spirit to come together. What was it, Sister Maureen, that they felt called to do?
I think maybe to put the council in some sort of perspective is that in the 2,000-year history of the Church, we had 20 such ecumenical councils. The last one was held 100 years prior to Vatican II, and since at that council the bishops there articulated the teaching on papal infallibility, it was thought we would never have the need for another council. And so many in the Church were shocked when Pope John the 23rd announced that he was convening another council.
Wait, let me just jump in here, too,
sure,
for the uninitiated. So
yeah,
100 years prior, you're saying
1869, 1870 was the last ecumenical council of the Church. And because they had articulated this papal infallibility teaching,
in other words, the Pope can make no mistakes.
Well, when he's preaching in the matters of faith and morals for the good of the Church. And so many in the Church thought that that would be the final time we would ever have to come together to discuss important matters.
I see.
So when, 3 months after he was elected to the papacy, John the 23rd announced that he was convening another ecumenical council, this caused shockwaves throughout the entire church. And so one has to try to understand what was in John's mind when he called the council. All previous 20 councils were called to address doctrinal heresies, problems in the Church. That was not John's reason. He wanted this to be a pastoral council, pastoral in this sense. He saw, and I think because he was inspired to do so, he saw that the Church of the 1950s was becoming somewhat complacent, somewhat, comfortable with the faith, but not on fire with the faith. And so I think he saw this as a time to deepen and renew Christian faith. He hoped it would be an opportunity for the Christian churches to move toward Christian unity. And so he had his own goals in mind as to why he would call this council. And that was really the reason why he did call it.
Wow. And Father Kerper, I think the Pope said he wanted to, and I'm quoting him, throw open the windows of the Church. What do you think he was trying to say and do there?
I think the context was relatively close to the end of World War II, and World War II in Europe was a sort of inter-Christian conflict, as World War I was. And also, it was the time of the Cold War, and communism was still considered a very serious threat in the West. And I think Pope John the 23rd was trying to deal with all of the various potential calamities. Because I think living now, faced with terrorism, we forget that in the late 50s and the 60s, we were living with the fear of the total destruction of the world.
Right.
And I think Pope John the 23rd wanted to re-engage the church in the concern of the world. And rather than just being a kind of enclosed sectarian entity, he wanted the church to become an active partner in healing the world and bringing together humanity rather than dividing humanity. So I think he was very, very much devoted to unity, not only among Christians, but among all people of goodwill. That was one of his hallmarks.
And it's so interesting to hear you say that, because Sister Maureen, you know, you hear 1962, 50 years ago, and you think, oh, ideal times, no problem. You know, as Father Kerper said, you know, we weren't thinking about terrorism and so forth. But troubling times, too. I mean, there were some real clouds of fear and some upheavals going on in society, and I'm guessing Vatican II reflected that.
The church always reflects the society or the period in which it lives. And if you think about it, the Second Vatican Council opened in probably one of the most turbulent decades the American history has ever known, the 60s. And so it was incredible that he would call a council at this time of upheaval, not only in the church, but as Father Kerper says, in the world. And just to comment on something Father Kerper said, which I think is just so valid, in that prior to the Second Vatican Council, the Roman Catholic Church's attitude toward the world at large was one of, as many authors have called it, a state of siege mentality. Somehow we saw ourselves as separate from the world in which we lived. John the 23rd saw something else. He wanted us to be in dialogue with this modern world. And so that would have been another goal, that if this world is the creation of God, then in and of itself, it is a good thing. And rather than see it as the enemy to be nominated, it was rather a partner to be in dialogue with. So, yes, it reflected a very difficult time period.
Yeah, and that change was huge. And even though as a non-Catholic, I'm aware of some of the internal changes that Vatican II meant. Everybody talks about the end of the Latin Mass, for example, and in parishioners' native tongues. But, Father Kerper, this point that you guys are getting towards is huge, the Catholic Church's relationship with the rest of the world. Can you just paint a before and after picture for us? Because that's really significant.
Sister mentioned Vatican I, and not only did that pertain to the question of papal infallibility, but it also was a reaction to what the church saw as its encirclement. It was coming at a time when monarchies in Europe were ending. It was coming at a time where the classical union of church and state was ending. Italy was being unified under a republican system of government rather than a monarchy. And the church just felt that everything was falling apart. It's interesting, if you read texts before the council, many bishops were saying, nobody's going to church, secularism is rampant.
Wow, that's
it's
what we say
today.
It's
all the things that we hear today. And the reaction was to become enclosed. And I think many times when religious groups, political groups feel embattled, there's a tendency to become enclosed. And that extended up into the 1870s, up until the time of John the 23rd. But there were already, even in the 40s and 50s, among theologians, especially the French theologians, a sense we can't become a sect. And so he was very intent on getting away from the idea that we had to erect walls, and he was taking the walls down and recognizing that we have a basic kinship with others. One of the principal things of the council was the rediscovery of the sacrament of baptism as the principle of unity, because up until that time, many times Catholics looked upon Protestants as not being Christians. And even today, I'll have people say, but Catholics aren't Christians. And it was the whole recovery of the sense that there is an essential unity that has been disrupted.
Among
and
humanity.
One of his principal goals was to unify the Christian people, regardless of the past historical crises and conflicts.
And to improve relations with other religions,
exactly.
Specifically
especially
Judaism,
the Jewish
right?
People,
yeah, tell us a little bit more
Islam.
About that.
Yeah, there was the document that came out on relationships with other Christian groups, but also with Judaism and Islam, who were always held up as being very close to us in that they're monotheistic religions.
But the whole Vatican II point, and this is another sort of radical departure, right? Sister Maureen, correct me if I'm wrong, was the recognition that there are other paths to salvation and the recognition of Judaism and Islam as, I don't know how else to say it, but valid religions that we could get together and pray together and talk about these things. It doesn't matter if you're Jewish or Muslim.
I think this was one of the most incredible contributions of the Council to the ongoing theology of church, because growing up as a child before the Second Vatican Council, I had been taught that outside the Roman Catholic Church there could be no salvation. And this was very disturbing to me, even as a child, to think that all those Jews, you know, and Jesus was Jewish, or all those people in Africa would somehow be, unable to be saved. And for years, as Father Kerper mentioned, there were those French theologians who were really making strides in looking back at the New Testament and looking at the early church fathers to find ways that we could speak about a positive outlook toward other religions. And so the document Nostra Aetate, in our time, which was directed toward non-Christian religions, basically said, we recognize that there are rays of truth in all religions, and we respect all that is good and holy in their religions. And perhaps in one of my most favorite documents, Gaudium et Spes, the Pastoral Constitution on the Church in the Modern World, Article 22, when it talks about who can be saved, you know, the association with the Paschal Mystery, it says, in a manner known only to God, we ought to believe that the gift of the Holy Spirit will be offered to every man and woman. And so this was a major development occurring that we stepped back and said, we don't decide who gets saved. God decides.
Wow. Big deal. All right. We will talk after a very short break. We'll look ahead to how we're interpreting and viewing Vatican II today. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHVR 919. Good morning. And more of our review of Vatican II on The Exchange. And at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, identifying and treating severe mental illness. Stay with NHVR this holiday season. We've scheduled a number of special programs telling stories that remind us all what this season is about. And of course, we'll bring you lots of music to bring you some of that holiday cheer. Have a look at our full holiday schedule at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from UR members in Lars Heating Systems, manufacturing boilers and water heaters for homes and commercial buildings for over 60 years. Built in New Hampshire with pride, LAARS.com. From Goose Bay Lumber Company of Chichester, providing specialty lumber for wood artisans, turners, furniture craftsmen, and boat builders. Now offering gift certificates for the holidays, GooseBayLumber.com. And Markham & Marge of Keene, New Hampshire, worldwide coating supplier, making their mark through people and innovation locally and globally for over 100 years. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, 50 years later, the impact of Vatican II on the worldwide Catholic Church and here in New Hampshire. We invite you to join us with your questions or comments, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. If you're not Catholic, or if you are Catholic, you can join us. What questions do you have about Vatican II, what it meant for one of the world's major religions? And if you are of the Catholic faith, how do you feel about some of the changes that stemmed from Vatican II? Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. Sister Maureen Sullivan is here, Associate Professor of Theology at St. Anselm College, along with Father Michael Kerper, pastor of St. Patrick Parish in Nashua. And before we go to our listeners, both of you, just one or two more things that I want to wrap up from Vatican II on this 50th anniversary, and then look forward to how we're talking about it today. Sister Maureen, Vatican II meant huge changes for women in the church.
It did make... Now we're looking back and we're seeing the implications of that. But you have to remember that it was 1962 to 1965. The women's movement in the United States was just in its inception. And so at the first two sessions at the Second Vatican Council, no women were present. And it was only at the second session that Cardinal Sunens of Belgium said, here we are legislating for the whole church and we have no females. And so at the next, at the third session, Pope Paul VI invited female auditors. They weren't allowed to vote, but they were there. They were able to give their input to bishops, etc. So that was the beginning, I think, of the input of women. But I would say that in the 50 years since the council, not only for, let's say, female religious, and you know, members of religious orders, but for women all over the world, and I can speak specifically for the United States, if you take a look at the fact that, according to statistics, something like 85% of lay ministers in the United States Catholic churches today, that work is being done by women.
Wow,
and so
a lot.
Clearly it opened the door for the validity and the role of women in the church, for them to be educated and be prepared to serve in the church. And I would like to see a lot more progress for women in the church as we move forward.
Yeah, we'll definitely talk about that. But just a reminder, so before the role of women was largely teaching Catholic schools.
Correct.
Or working Catholic hospitals, it really emerged into this social justice role.
It did, and there are many videos and many stories that have been told that I entered my congregation and I thought I'd be teaching first grade for the rest of my life. Now, I did stay in the field of education, you know, I teach at St. Anselm College, but so many of the sisters in my congregation were then free to pursue what were other ministries. We have sisters who work with the deaf. We have sisters who are working in third world countries for peace and justice issues. We have sisters who are working with the poor at the most extreme levels. And so I think what religious congregations in general, which I know most about, have opened the doors for the Spirit, for the Holy Spirit to inspire us to go where the needs of the people of God are. So clearly there is a diversity of ministries available to women in the church today, which we would not have had before Vatican II.
Our phone number again here on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And let's go to our audience now, both of you. And Pasto's calling from Manchester. Hi, Pasto. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead, Pasto. You're on the air.
Yes. To know if about the Latin Mass. I heard that there was something done recently that this Mass could be said in all churches, but people I talked to and said to me that not in all churches this Mass is available now. So I want to know what's the update about that.
Yeah, thank you very much, Pastor. That was a big change, the Latin Mass that largely went away after Vatican II. Father Kerper.
Yeah, hi, Pastor. What you're discussing is what was called the motu proprio, which came out in 2007 by Pope Benedict XVI, which gave permission to any priest who was able to learn the rubrics and who had sufficient knowledge of Latin to celebrate the Mass for a particular group in the parish. And prior to that, in our diocese, that was not permitted. What has happened is the Latin Mass now is available in certain places. St. Patrick's in Nashville, we have it the second Sunday of the month at noon. We have it every Saturday morning at 8 o'clock. Some people were very disturbed by that, and they saw it as a retrenchment and a going away from the spirit of Vatican II. I would suggest that it's actually the fruit of Vatican II, because one of the things that Vatican II very much emphasized was diversity in the church and a plurality not only in terms of theological systems, but also it recognized a plurality in forms of worship. And it's rather interesting that Pope Benedict has authorized two forms of the liturgy, what's called the ordinary and the extraordinary. And that really doesn't contradict the council. The council very much wanted to allow the Eastern rites to retain their autonomy and to permit a great deal of diversity. So it's not something that is coming back as being mandated, but it's there as an option for people who prefer it. One of the strange things is that many of the people who come to it tend to be younger people rather than old people.
That's
which
interesting.
I thought pretty strange.
Yeah, what do you think about that, Sister Maureen?
You know what? I think part of it is a curiosity for what once was.
Sure.
Because in many of our classes, we're trying to present them with how the church has grown and has developed. And so having never experienced the Latin Mass and hearing all of the discussion about it, I think many of them, this is one way of answering it. I think many of them are curious to see what was it like, all right? Another part, and I think this is quite genuine, I think there are those who have missed elements of the Latin Mass. There is this majesty, there is this mystery, there is this beauty, there is this transcendence that I think many of our young people today are seeking. They are spiritual seekers, and I think there may be something in that celebration that calls them. And so, as far as I'm concerned, whatever celebration of the liturgy brings our young people today to worship and to be in touch with their God, I think is a positive move.
And in terms of the seeking, we also have to remember that young people today never had that experience. And what
of the
older people, you know, people in their 50s and on upwards, experience as the new Mass, for young people, it's their old Mass.
Yeah.
And so they're looking for something different. Also, in terms of its connection with Vatican II, one of the things that Vatican II did was not so much to do something new as to recover the old, especially going back to Scripture, which in many cases had been lost, and a recovery of the church fathers, most of whom wrote in Greek. And so there was the term ressourcement, which meant going back to the sources. And I think with the fact that we now have two forms of the liturgy that represents part of the spirit of Vatican II, which was to recover the entirety of the tradition, parts of which had been lost.
Our phone number again is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. We're taking your questions and comments about what Vatican II 50 years ago meant for the Catholic Church and the new challenges that the Church faces today. Also, how Catholics today view Vatican II, how they feel about it. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. And Tom is calling in from Concord. Hi, Tom. You're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, good morning. Father, sister, thank you for all that you do. And Laura, love your show. Thank you.
Thanks.
You guys addressed some of the, I guess, the question I want to ask, and I hope I formulate it properly. But, you know, I'm a cradle Catholic, younger generation Catholic, and I guess I see a lot of people in my generation migrating to what I've termed alternative religions, things that fit their needs, rather than the steadfast church that the Catholic Church is. Do you suppose in the future the church will modify even more to mold to the modern day society that we live in, as you kind of mentioned, Sister? I guess I'm kind of wondering, is that ever going to happen?
What kind of molding do you mean, Tom?
Well, when I was a kid, there were no youth masses, for instance. Now we have youth masses with bands and things like that, which really, and I have teenage children, so those are great for us, great. Those pull us in. First is just liturgy, but those are the things that keep us going. We see more modern-day changes.
Changes of substance or style, Tom?
Yeah, probably both.
Yeah. All right. What do you think, Sister Maureen? This is a question that a lot of people are looking at. You know, do we need to, we meaning the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. need to embrace that spirit of modernization that Vatican II represents?
Absolutely, yes. We do have to grow because the Church, though divinely founded and divinely guided, is in the hands of humans. And these humans have to address a human audience. And this human audience is growing and develop. I mean, the Pope is on Twitter. All right. So, I mean, so he's, even he's taking up some sort of modern understanding or the need to evangelize using the means that our young people might have access to today. So in response to this gentleman's question, I have two things. One of the things that all three popes, John the 23rd, John Paul II, and currently Benedict the 16th have said is that we preach the gospel. The gospel does not change. However, we need to make use of every means, method, technology, whatever it is, to reach this generation. We're no longer walking into a classroom where Thomas Aquinas met 13th century university students that were versed in philosophy. My students at St. Anselm College have a totally different genre that of audience that I have to meet. And so I have to take the same gospel that Aquinas took in the 13th century and find a way of expressing it to this new generation. And yet, so that's what I would say first. Yes, we do have to continue to find ways to meet what is attractive, appealing, and that our students will find that their church is doing what they want them to do. On the other hand, the gospel is an objective norm of morality. So the gospel will never so be bent in attempt that it simply meets the needs of the majority of the current population. It has to hold fast to the ideal. And that, I think, is the tension that the church in every generation has had to come to terms with.
And, you know, Tom mentioned and you mentioned, Sister Maureen, changes that I would call more around the methods of preaching the gospel, maybe style over substance, so Twitter and, mm-hmm. and Tom's example of rock bands. But I've got a couple emails here that talk about substance, changes in substance. And here's one that came in earlier, anonymous user, so didn't want their name used. Mm-hmm. In regards to a need for Vatican III, at this time, given the very conservative pope and equally conservative bishops he's appointed, I think another conclave would only send the Roman Catholic Church back a few decades. As a lifelong Catholic who has recently left the church, I believe that the church should ordain women, that priests should be allowed to marry, and that the top-down operation should be changed to a more lay-friendly, responsible model. And I want to thank this person for emailing. And these are some of the issues of substance, Father Kerper, that some people would like to see in the church. Never mind Twitter and Facebook and
it's an
technological changes.
Question, because in that question is the necessity to distinguish between the substance and that which is changeable. The question of the ordination of women, which of course has been very contentious, is something that was never addressed by the council, but there are two elements of the council's teaching that touch upon that. The first, which I already mentioned, was the preeminence of baptism. The principal sacrament is baptism, not holy orders. And as long as the discussion excessively focuses on the condition of the clergy and the number of the clergy, I think it's a movement away from the council. The second part of the spirit of the council that pertains to that, which many people don't get because we're in the United States, is the council was very, very insistent on collegiality with other Christians. We are in dialogue with the Orthodox. The Orthodox have a understanding of the Sacrament of Orders, which currently does not include the ordination of women. And so our own process of discerning about that issue is always tied in with the Orthodox. We could not do it unilaterally.
I guess I don't understand that. Maybe I'm showing my lack of understanding of the Catholic Church. The Orthodox meaning?
Meaning the Eastern churches who are not in communion with Rome. And so
are they still Catholic?
We said there's one holy Catholic and apostolic church. We regard them as brothers and sisters in the faith. They are not in full communion with us, and they don't regard ourselves as being in full communion with them. But everything that we do in terms of doctrine is very much aware of the Orthodox position. And the ordination of women necessarily involves that. That's a matter of substance. The questioner had asked about the married clergy.
Yes.
That is not a matter of substance. That is something that is very different from the ordination of women. That's not a matter of doctrine. It's a matter of discipline. But once again, it pulls us away from recognizing the preeminence of baptism, that the church is not about the clergy. We obviously need the clergy, but the church is a collegial body. It's the body of Christ. And unfortunately, I think a lot of times we focus very much on expanding the clergy, altering the clergy, whatever.
Especially given priest shortages.
Which really
and so
misses
forth.
The point, which the council said all the baptized have the vocation to be the church.
Sister Maureen, can you comment on that too?
Yeah,
the role
of
women, and maybe if we have time, also married priests.
Well, I would pick up on something that Father Kerper said. I come at this from a slightly different point of view. Building on his valid, very valid point about the centrality of baptism, yes, all of the Roman Catholic Christians are baptized. We are all called to holiness. One of my great concerns is that the church must provide the possibility for the membership to have a sacramental life. And right now we are reaching a point in our church where we have such a shortage of ordained ministers that as important as the baptized membership is, they cannot consecrate the bread, they cannot give absolution in confession. And so the sacramental life of the Roman Catholic Church right now is in need of some attention, and that worries me, that we just don't have enough. When I first came to St. Anselm College, I spoke about priestless parishes, but I was talking about Nairobi. Now I'm talking about priestless parishes here in New Hampshire. And so one of the points that I make in my church course is that...
Sister Maureen, I have to cut you off,
sure.
And I do apologize. We'll pick it up after a break. All right, stand by.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and Franklin Pierce University, a leader in adult education, offering a Master of Science in Information Technology Management. New term begins soon. Information at franklinpierce.edu. And Elliott Gastroenterology and Endoscopy, treating individuals with diseases of the stomach, esophagus, and colon at the Elliott at River's Edge in Manchester. ElliottRiversEdge.org. Good morning. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear from people who really make you think, like astrophysicist Brian Green explaining the scientific theory that our universe is just one of many.
And the image that I like to have in mind is, imagine that our universe is like one slice of bread in a much grander cosmic loaf, with the other slices of bread being other universes.
No subject is too big for Fresh Air. Join us weekdays at 3 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, a new take on the high cost of college, especially at state-run universities. Email us your questions or concerns before the show at exchange@nhpr.org. And join us tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today in The Exchange, the impact of Vatican II on the Catholic Church and how it's being viewed 50 years later. Join our conversation, 1-800-892-6477. If you have questions about what Vatican II was all about, some of the changes that stemmed from it, or comments about Vatican II and how it's being viewed by Catholics today. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Sister Maureen, just before the break, we were digging into the thorny issue of whether women should be allowed to be ordained. You mentioned priest shortages, and if I'm reading you right, it seems like you're saying it's too bad that women can't be ordained because there are not enough people to conduct communion and other vital priestly functions.
At this point in time, because of the church's position on female ordination, I'm not taking a position for it or against it. I'm asking for our church to do something that the early church was able to do. And Father Kerper touched on it before. When those theologians in the decades before Vatican II were doing their research into the New Testament and into the church fathers, they were finding that, especially within the earliest church communities, As new needs arose within the church community, they would develop structures to meet those needs.
This is in the very early church.
In the very early church, first 100 years even or so, first 200 years. And so frequently the Church of Corinth might not have looked exactly like the Church of Ephesus or the Church of Rome or the Church of Jerusalem. They were together in the essential faith, but they would develop structures that would meet the needs of their particular community. We have needs right now in our church community that are quite serious, and that is we have a need for more ordained ministers to serve the sacramental life of the people of God. And I have great concerns about that. So I'm not so much that I have great answers as to how we do it, but that we take seriously the need to take a look at some structures. And one thing that could be said is that for the first 12 centuries in the Christian Church, which now is the Roman Catholic Church, we did have a married priesthood.
Oh, really? And, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so I think it was at the Second Lateran Council in 1139 where it was mandatory celibacy was finally imposed. And so we have had a married priesthood. And the Eastern Rite churches that are in communion with us do have a married priesthood. So leaving the more thorny issue of female ordination aside, I think the easier structure to at least consider right now might be the possibility. This would never affect religious orders like Benedictines, Dominicans, Franciscans, because they take different vows. But for the secular priesthood, we did have a married priesthood. That might be something that we might consider to meet the sacramental life of the church today.
Okay, and I did not know that again, so that's interesting. Yeah, Father Kerper.
The matter of the priestless parishes leads into something else, and that is parishes without people. We have to recognize that in our diocese, normally only 20% of baptized Catholics currently participate in the Eucharist. And so I find it somewhat paradoxical to be concerned about not having enough clergy when in many cases the churches are almost empty in certain parts of the state. And one of the reasons we have fewer and fewer clergy, and this is beginning to change a little bit, is there are fewer and fewer people who bring their children to worship on a regular basis.
So it's a circle,
so
isn't it?
The pool, the potential pool, is always shrinking. The other thing is, in historical perspective, Catholics in the United States, the ratio of priests to people is about 1 to 2,500. The worldwide ratio is 1 to 4,000. Mexico is 1 to 10,000.
Oh, really?
And
wow.
It's not so much a shortage of clergy as a crisis of convenience. Whereas once a parish might have had 5 masses, now it only has 2. Every day in Nashua, there are probably 7 or 8 masses within the space of 3 or 4 miles. So people in the 40s and 50s were used to having a superabundance of priests, which I think was a problem. I used to be with an old pastor who used to say, yeah, we had a lot of priests, but we didn't have that many vocations, meaning that the priesthood for a time up through the 50s and 60s was a step out of blue-collar ethnic community. And so I think we went through a bubble time. And there are a lot of people that still have that memory.
I see. So it kind of depends on how you measure it.
Yeah. It's historical perspective. We've always had a priest shortage.
Our phone number again is 1-800-892-6477. Email us with your questions or comments about Vatican II and what it means for today's Catholics. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And here's another email, again from someone who didn't want their name used. This is unusual this morning. 2 people didn't want their names read on the air. This person says, if the Catholic Church had stayed true to Vatican II, I might still be a Catholic. As I am gay, I found a loving, open Christian church. I was unwelcome in the church. The Catholic Church is too focused on sex with dire consequences. Sister Maureen, this is a tough issue. What do you think?
It's a very tough issue.
I'm wondering if students at St. Anselm also talk
no
to you about this.
There's no question about it. Yeah. I think we have to come a long way, I think, in trying to understand how do we speak to a new generation about sexual morality. And I think we in the church have to come to terms with. I'm not a moral theologian, so I would never be the first. Ecclesiology is my area, so I would never be the first to say, well, this is the answer to this issue. As I said before, the gospel doesn't change, and the essence of the truth of how we understand how the gospel needs to be portrayed does not change. But there is also a pastoral dimension to how we present the truth to a new generation. And so I guess I'm surprised that I'm seeing so many references to bishops from all over the world who seem to be taking a more broad understanding of how we might deal with some of the pastoral issues in the church, for example, with divorced and remarried Catholics, you know, with our gay population. I think we have to take a much more serious look at these issues and understand them better. Not being a moral theologian, I can't draw on a bag of tricks to be able to say, well, this would be one way we could do it. But clearly, I think we have to do something. The church is inclusive. The church needs to find a way to be a beacon of the truth for all members of the church, whatever their gender, direction, etc. Might be. But it is clearly a problem for this younger generation.
So and I just want to ask you a quick question. I'm sorry, Father Kerper. So are you saying, Sister Maureen, that gay people who maybe grew up in the church, are you saying, stay with us? I mean, don't, you know, we want you, because this emailer feels unwanted by the Catholic Church.
Oh, I would think there's every effort on the part of the Catholic Church to hold and to keep all members of the church, you know, always our children, I think, was the document that was put out by the bishops a number of years ago. And there's no doubt in my mind that the church official, the church whoever, who speaks for the church in no way is desirous of eliminating a portion of the church that does not seem to fit into a norm or some sort of a model. So I don't doubt that the person who wrote that email feels that strongly, because there has been enough negative language and enough negative, you know, publicity about how we deal with the gay population. But I deal with students every single day who want to be a part of our church and are looking for ways to do so. And I'm making every effort to make them understand that this church has a home. And I would just add one other point. Father Kerper said something before about the Vatican II documents. John the 23rd was at great pains to say when he issued the documents, they were not issued to our brothers and sisters in Christ. They were not issued to my brother bishops. They were addressed to all of humanity. Vatican II was meant to have a universal message to the people of God. And that includes gays, all of us.
Okay. Yeah. Father Kerper, yes. Big question facing the church.
Yeah. As a pastor, I would just like to speak to the person who wrote that and to assure him or her of our love for all of the people that come into the church. One thing that often comes into my mind today is the parable of the wheat and the weeds. And Jesus told the parable of a group of slaves who wanted to tear up the garden, the field, and get rid of the weeds. There are always people who want to purge people out of the church prematurely. And one of the things I've learned as a pastor is every parish has all kinds of people, some of whom are very knowledgeable, other ones who are confused, other ones who are trapped in various kinds of addictions, sin, all kinds of things. And it's a field that includes all kinds of people. The Catholic Church is extremely diverse, and people are always using their own conscience, making their own adaptations, and learning to live. And as a pastor, what I've come to learn is no one is finished. And I always have to have the patience and the humility to wait for God to work with each person who is loved by God and who has to be loved by the church. And I think, Sister Maureen, and anyone involved in ministry, that is our primary commitment. Nobody ever gets everything with the I's dotted and the T's crossed. We always are primarily concerned about being agents of God's love. And sometimes I think people focus too much on texts and on having everything properly in order.
Well, it's something that we won't resolve this hour, I'm sure of that. But Vatican II, I'm guessing Father Kirper, was silent on this particular issue.
Vatican II simply repeated the classical church's understanding of sexuality, that sexuality is meant to express love and create new life, but it doesn't really go directly into specific issues. That wasn't the purpose of the council.
Were there other issues in your mind, Father Kirper or Sister Maureen, that Vatican II left on the table that need to be addressed now? What do you think, Father Kirper? I'll go to you first.
There were many things that were not specifically addressed. I think probably the number one disappointment of Pope John the 23rd and Paul the 6th was the failure to move forward towards Christian unity. What has impeded that in recent time is the divisions within Christian communities themselves.
So what does that mean exactly?
Well, there's been a polarization within various churches. Take the Anglican Communion, which is very polarized. There's polarization in the Catholic Church. There are Catholics who won't speak to other Catholics, and there are people within the mainline Protestant churches that don't want to speak to evangelicals. So there's been this unfortunate kind of hardening of positions, so that there are now some Catholics who would rather deal with evangelicals rather than with Episcopalians. And as somebody imbued with Vatican II, it's a heartbreaking situation that we're in, because it's been very politicized and oftentimes affected by debates in the broader culture. So I think in terms of disappointment, that would be the number one area, that we have not really moved forward towards some kind of unity. There is a greater sense of companionship. Many clergy are friends with clergy from other particular Christian groups, and even beyond Christianity, into Judaism and even Islam.
Sure, there are a lot of interfaith prayer breakfasts,
yes,
and interfaith councils addressing problems like homelessness and so forth. What do you think, Sister Maureen? What was left on the table, and is it time for Vatican III?
I used to think it was time for Vatican III. There was a time in my life that I was thinking about it, and I thought, gee, that's what we need, because there are some issues, let's say collegiality, the role of women in the church, that really cannot be handled at the local level. You know, Bishop Peter Labashi right here in New Hampshire would not have the autonomy to make major decisions without his brother bishops. But I've since left my dream of Vatican III behind right now for this reason. I think we're still studying the documents of Vatican II, and there is a great amount of disagreement on how best to interpret those documents right now. So I think we still have a great deal of work to do to try to understand what it is that Vatican II was, tried to do, and what doors it opened for us today. And I would not say so much that topics were left off the table. I would rather look at it as there were lines in the documents that left the door open for future discussion without being specific. At one point, one of the documents says, the church now yearns to unfold more clearly. All right. What does that word unfold mean? It means that we can move, we can change, we can develop. Another line said that the church, meaning the Council Fathers' comment, we need to listen to all the voices in the world. Again, that's not very specific, but they could never have known the kinds of voices that would be out there, voice of the faithful, voice of women, voice of the gay population. They could, but they laid the groundwork for the possibility that we would be open to the listening of the voices in the world. So I think there are more theological, foundational possibilities for ongoing discussion than necessarily having to have another council at this point in time to thrash over those issues. One other thing, most people that I trust in the field, most theologians that I follow, claimed that it would take 50 years before the seeds of the council would spring up and take root and whatever, and we are at that point right now. So I would like to think, and I'm grateful to be a part of the discussion, because we are at a point in time now where enough dust has settled where we might be able to listen to those voices in the world, continue to yearn to unfold what we believe is the mission of the church in the world. And as Cardinal Sunens once said, to hope is not a luxury, it is a duty. I have extreme hope for the future of our church. And when I see what my students and how they respond to the Second Vatican Council course that I teach, I think they are the 21st century church. And I sleep well as a result of that.
Say that again. To hope is...
To hope is not a duty, not a luxury. It's a duty.
Yeah, in these rather dark
times. And he said,
We
never expected John the 23rd. We never expected the council either. But who's to say that the unconditional love of God is exhausted? Our God is still with us. We were promised the gift of the Holy Spirit by the risen Christ. I have no doubt that that Spirit continues to work in us today.
Sister mentioned sleeping well, and I remember a little comment of John the 23rd when someone said to him, how can you sleep at night with the condition of the church? And he said, I say a prayer, I go to bed, I turn off the light, and I say, God, the church is yours, I'm going to sleep. He was a man of hope and patience. The Catholic Church is very old, very big. It moves slowly. And as Sister mentioned, the 50 years, it took 100 years after the Council of Trent to implement the decisions of that council. So it is about patience and hope and joy, even in the midst of very difficult times.
Yeah.
And perhaps some trust in each other.
And I know that a couple days before Christmas, this is a very busy time for both of you. So I especially want to thank you for coming in.
Well, thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Father Michael Kerper, pastor of St. Patrick Parish in Nashua. He also writes for Parable Magazine. Sister Maureen Sullivan, associate professor of theology at St. Anselm College and an expert on the Second Vatican Council. She's also a Dominican Sister of Hope in New York. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Today we say a sad and fond farewell to our fabulous intern, Samantha Johnson. Sam, you've been a bright presence on our staff. We'll miss not only your talents, but your quirky attachments to unconventional presidential candidates. Goodbye, Sam. Best of luck. This is NHPR.